Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 14, delivered on October 3rd.
Today, structure of interest rates. Couple of things before I get started. Again, as I've already announced, Tuesday is review for the exam, and I will give you what I think you should know, and then I'm going to say, what questions do you have? If you're all quiet, you get to go home after 20, 25 minutes. But if you want to really do well on the exam, you would probably start asking me questions. So prep questions this weekend. And you, as I said, if you say, is this going to be on the test, and it's not, I'll say, no, I'm not going to ask that. And I will give you some insights through your questions. But that's where you have to be dynamically interacting with me so that you can actually do your best on the exam. So be sure that you have questions if you want them. And again, this is based upon the lectures and your outside readings. This is not the textbook. Something I've might be in the textbook, probably will be, but it is what I have said in class. So keep your eyes on the notes that you've made, and also, of course, on the podcasts. And the way I recommend you do it, you just sit down, open your notes, and listen to the podcast, and fill in what you missed when you were listening to the lecture originally. Excuse me. And from there, it's just your call. You can, of course, you have a note card, and you can have your formula sheet for the exam as well. And if we look at the numbers, just for a minute, on the markets today, we can say, I don't know, let's try something I haven't bothered for a while here. Good day or bad day?
Good day.
It was kind of a lackluster day at the lunch hour, and then it just picked up steam, and it just decided, well, we're going to have a good day today. Strong on all of them. You notice that the Dow was up the least at 47 hundredths of a percent. Then the S&P 500 was up 8 tenths of a percent, and the NASDAQ was up strongly, which indicates that whatever good news was there today that made the market happy was better news for the smaller caps than for the larger caps. And you can see the pattern was very much in play. Now, if we look over here at the bond market really quickly, we'll see that a lot of that money that poured into equities today came out of bonds, so the reverse flight to quality coming back in. Oddly, though, there's that gold still had a day. There are the investors who are still putting money into gold, and that's just simply hedging your bets. Quite honestly, I'm doing the same thing in my own portfolio, still in the equities, but also building that defensive position in gold ETFs of gold, and also doing some other things called protective put floors. But if you want to look at something else here, interestingly enough, if we look at the Standard Poor's 500, you notice that the day started off kind of lackluster, and then there was this steep drop-off. Do you see this bear spike right there? You see it? Where the bear just came in, and it would just fell off a cliff. And there was a lot of panic, real bad day. And then you had a bull hit right here, pushing it back up. And then for the rest of the day, it just kind of drifted upward on its own accord. However, we still have this giant elephant sitting in the middle of the room. Low volume. The heavies are staying off to the side. This was their clients moving stocks and bonds, but the big dogs are just sitting there waiting for the other shoe to drop. So you have only half of the volume today of a typical day over the past year. And that's just a serious concern to us that quiet before the storm is still sitting there, warning us that things could get bad sooner rather than later. But also another thing, notice that politics really doesn't play into market expectations all that much. Down days and up days don't have a whole lot, at least in the short run, to do with a president being impeached or some congressman proposing a new round of welfare for everyone. It's really playing itself out based upon the economy itself. And that is something that we are going to talk about in some detail. I'm going to give you a historical example today. It takes a while. Take good notes. Just make sure that you know that I could ask this on the test, something about this. But more importantly, you've probably never been told these stories before. The way we teach history now is just terrible. It's denying you the chance to see where things have been from start, where you are now based on what's happened before you. And also, notice, look for patterns and similarities between past and present. And so I do that here in the context of interest rates as I've been talking about them. Specifically, you will recall that an interest rate, whatever it is, will have two big pieces. It will have the risk-free rate, and it will have the risk premium in it. And within these two, in the risk-free rate, there are these two pieces. The real rate of return, which is just basically the price based upon the supply and demand of money. Plus, it will have an expected inflation premium. These two play with each other. They are not independent. But the fun they have is a long-run thing. And you would have to look at a historical period to see how they play. But it's not a speculation. It's not just a theory. It's real. It is quite real. And politicians pretend it doesn't exist, and those who are not educated pretend that all of this is meaningless to their lives, but that doesn't mean it is meaningless. Now, you remember that the risk premium is the default premium plus the maturity premium plus the illiquidity or liquidity premium. And those three are different for different securities. The interest rate on a home loan would have a relatively small default premium. It would have a big maturity premium if it's a 30-year, and it would have no liquidity premium because there's a great secondary mortgage market, big, vast, and efficient. But the action, and by the way, as we approach a recession, this default premium will pretty much go up for all securities. I mean, it's like there's more chance of default for anything, no matter how high quality it is, except for a government debt instrument, as we get closer to a recession. There was an article yesterday, took me aback, on financial analysts were looking at the top 25 retailers that are at great risk of going default in the next year. And that was kind of shaking, rattling to me. I knew a number of them, but some of them, you had, of course, JCPenney. Some of the others on the list were Pier 1. What else was on there? Bed Bath & Beyond, BBBY. One that kind of took me by surprise, Neiman Marcus. I went and looked at their financials. Yeah, they are in some pretty heavy sledding territory. Express was on the list. So we're seeing that looking into the depth of a recession, we are expecting, or at least these analysts, and I respect the one I know, his work, they were projecting 12,000 retail stores going out of business in the next year. 12,000. That's a lot. And of course, that's up from what we had last year, which was still a pretty hard number, 8,500 last year. So we are seeing that default premium, even on healthier companies, starting to expand because of the greater probabilities of default of companies, of bankruptcy, in a recession and in the pre-recession. The warning signs have been there for a couple of years, for at least a year, year and a half, that there was a recession coming. 8,500 retailers last year, that was a warning sign right there. And projecting now out into 2020, 12,000, yeah. That's going to make that default premium for all instruments go up. But anyway, there's that on the table. Now, another small matter that I want to bring up now is that this is an oversimplified beast right here. This right here. It's really, these interest rates don't interact additively. In other words, they don't add. They actually interact in a slightly more complex way. It's actually basic physics, is that we can do additions to, and we're not far off doing an addition, but technically, we would want to do a calculation based upon something called the Fisher effect. The Fisher effect works like this. It is not really, and I'll use a risk-free rate, it's not really R sub real plus the expected inflation premium. That's not really what happens. It's actually 1 plus R sub real plus quantity, not plus, times 1 plus the expected inflation premium. And then minus 1. So the real formula is the second one. Now, the difference is actually quite minimal, as I'll show you an example here in a minute. When the numbers are small, it begins to be noticeable, the error in the additive formula, when you get to larger numbers. But let me do one like this one. Suppose that we were going to say, let's say R sub real is 1.5%, and the expected inflation premium is right now running at 1.2%. Now, by the simple formula, then the risk-free rate would be 1.5% plus 1.2%, which would come out to be 2.7%, a risk-free rate of 2.7%. Okay. However, if we do it recognizing the Fisher effect, it would be the risk-free rate would be 1 plus 0.015 times 1 plus 0.012 minus 1. And if I just pull up a basic calculator and run those, I would say, okay, 1.015 times 1.012 minus 1, 2.718. So, again, as I said, it's very small when the numbers are little. It does get to be noticeable when the numbers are bigger. And in fact, in one place in finance, and truth be told, I'm not going to even show it to you. They bring it up in the book, but I did it in the first class. It's something that really is more of a next course, 242 course kind of thing. But there's something called forward rates and spot rates that mean that when we look at yield curves, we're not really seeing what's happening in the future rates. We're seeing a composite of the current rate. So, but I think I'm just going to bail on that and not show that large, that more complex thing. It's not really complex, but it's just something, it's a 242 subject. Okay, so there's that. But like I said, whether you use the additive version or the Fisher effect version of this, we have to recognize that these two animals in the risk-free rate play together. Now, the real rate of return, as I said, is the result of the supply and demand dynamics for money. You've got a demand curve for money. Now, you remember probably from your macroeconomics class, we draw a short-term money supply curve as a downward sloping line, a perfectly inelastic. There's just an amount of it at any given time. Okay, and those two come together, and you have your current real rate of return. Okay? R sub real 1. That would be that number right there in the risk-free rate. Whatever it is. Okay, now, if we have a president who is howling for the Fed to lower interest rates, he wants them to even be below zero. Okay, that would mean that what he wants the Fed to do is to add liquidity to the economy, increase the supply of money, and so the price of money, R sub real, would go down. Okay, fine. The Fed would probably do that with open market operations. It would go to banks and say, we want to buy your treasury bills, here's some money in for them. And the banks would say, okie dokie, and that would essentially infuse money into the federal funds market. Wonderful. Okay. Well, on the other hand, if the Fed didn't want to do that, if the Fed wanted to drain liquidity, then it would simply move the supply of money the other way, toward the left. And that would cause that's three. So then that would cause the real rate of return to go up. Okay, fine. But there's a problem here, especially if you add to the money supply. Something happens in the long run. That, the expected inflation rate, starts to react. Not at first. Maybe not for a year, 2 years, maybe even 5 years. But sooner or later, printing more money than the economy can absorb just causes prices to go up. That's all it does. If you if the growth rate of the money supply is greater than the real growth rate of the economy, you'll have inflation. Well, that's bad enough, but you see, what really hurts is if that inflation sticks in the minds of the financial communities. In other words, if inflation just keeps happening over and over, then the Fed could say, all right, we're going to cut the money supply. Please, inflation, go away. The markets won't believe it. They'll still have their expectation. And they might have it for a very long time, especially if the Federal Reserve keeps saying that it's going to cut back the money supply, but it doesn't. Then, when the Fed starts promising, the markets don't believe it. Even when the Fed says, actually does cut the money supply, the markets don't believe it. And so, we can have a catastrophe happen. This is what happened as a result of policy that was carried out in the 1960s and clear through the 1970s. That policy had impact on, in good ways, on our country, and in finally, in really bad ways, even on our political process. And so I'm going to take you through that historical period for the purpose of illustrating this right here, and for you to begin to see what might be coming at us again now after all those years. I caution that in this, what I'm going to tell you, it sounds like I've got sometimes I'm talking like a Democrat, sometimes I'm talking like a Republican. I even use a very bad word here. So if you want to get your complaints together, bring it, okay? Because I'm quoting a president when I say one thing in this. But I have to begin before all of this happened. When we had a very stable economy. Stable is good. But you're the kind of guy, sir, you don't like stable. Stable means boring, and you are a wild and crazy guy. You want risk, excitement, danger even. I mean, you'll even watch Third Rock from the Sun sometimes. You'll watch The Big Bang Theory. Sometimes you'll eat macaroni and cheese with extra cheese. So some people like a lot of excitement, but a political process and an economy, we like things to be quiet, unless you're one of those speculators. For the most part, though, as business people, as consumers, we really want stability. Now, we market craziness. We love to tell you, the young people, well, this is extreme. No one's ever done this before. Wow, awesome. You are radical. Oh, no, you're not. But we tell you that just to sell our products to you. Really, people, societies, economies, financial markets like stability. And so I begin this with the 1950s. We had a president in the 1950s. His name was Dwight Eisenhower. Now, some would say he was the last of the true moderate Republicans. He was a former general, decorated from World War II, just a very upstanding, dignified man. In other words, he's not someone who would go on Twitter and tweet weird stuff. He was, well, we didn't have Twitter back then. His policy was very mainstream. Although he had signed a tax cut at the beginning of his administration, he then, all the calls after that, more tax cuts from the right-wing conservative Republicans in his own party. He said, no, I'm not giving any more. We did that. We need enough money to pay the government's bills. I'm not giving any more tax cuts. And of course, on the other side, though, when the liberals cried for more government programs of welfare and all that, he said, no, I'm not going to do that either. We have to pay the basic bills of government and leave it at that. And so his administration was nothing spectacular. The economy grew at a modest, maybe 2% or something like that. There wasn't any dramatic, wow, look at the economy growing, we're hot. And it didn't fall into recessions either. It just grew, and the budget stayed very stable. In fact, I believe his last year in office, there was a slight budget surplus, unlike our $1 trillion budget deficits right now. Again, very moderate in all of his policies. Well, he couldn't run for another term, so his vice president ran for office in 1960 against a Democrat. Now, one thing I should point out here, Eisenhower being a moderate, a conservative, in his last speech, his farewell speech to Congress, he gave this ominous warning. He said, beware of the military-industrial complex. which is odd coming from a war general. What he meant was, he said, don't ever let this engine of war and giant corporations control our government. Don't ever let that happen. So that'll come into play here in a while, his warning, and what the consequence of abandoning that and ignoring him was. But anyway, the election of 1960 pitted his conservative, more conservative than he was, Vice President Richard Nixon against an Irish Catholic war hero from World War II and consummate East Coast liberal named John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was a new kind of politician. Just open, very handsome. He was connected to all of the entertainment. He hung out with Sinatra and Dean Martin and those guys, the Rat Pack. And there were rumors that he'd had an affair with this lady named Marilyn Monroe. And I mean, he was just the consummate. Oh, you should have heard the conservative, the right word. My God, a Catholic, an Irish Catholic. The Pope's going to take over the country. You know that, don't you? The Antichrist and all that kind of stuff. He was a consummate politician. He and Nixon went into the first live televised debate ever. I remember it. It was disturbing. Because back then, you see, live TV was black and white, and light capturing by live cameras was not that great. You had to have these massive Klieg lights down blowing and all of this kind of stuff. And so here's Richard Nixon, old school conservative Republican, short man, hunched over under these lights. He literally looked like a monster, the poor son of a gun. He had shadows hanging down. He looked like he didn't even have eyes, kind of really nervous in front of this camera and these hot lights. And there was Jack Kennedy. Like he lived in the light. He would just step out. He knew how to stand under the lights so that he just glowed. And he had this brash certainty about him. He didn't talk like this, as Nixon did. He said, I am the answer to your problems of the 20th century. We will go forward as a nation. Ask not what your nation can do for you. Ask what you can do for your nation. It resonated. And poor Nixon lost that debate, looking like a gargoyle. And he lost the election to John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was liberal, but not in a way you might think in some ways, but he was such a politician, and he loved the limelight and the people. His wife, Jacqueline Bouvier, Jackie Kennedy, she took the nation on the first live tour of the White House. She had it redecorated and all of the Parisian fabrics. She always dressed in the greatest New York clothing, and she took the world on a tour of the White House. And he was there, this shining, handsome man, war hero, and he started laying out all of these plans for our future. They called the White House Camelot because it was like almost like a fairy tale in that time. Now, don't get me wrong, there were a lot of people who hated his guts. But Kennedy had all these plans. He gets up there in 1961 and he says, we are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this decade. And of course, you know, engineers and scientists were saying, yeah, that's good, Jack. Oh, you're serious? What? Are you out of your mind? Yeah, we're going to do that. Space exploration. He said, we are going to make people better off. That means we are going to wage a war on poverty. Hell, we beat the filthy Nazis back into the graves of hell. Why can't we win against poverty? So there was a war on poverty. And there was a war on discrimination. He was even talking about some civil rights act that would prohibit discrimination. It would say, you want to discriminate? You go to prison if you discriminate. And then he also was virulently anti-communist. The communists were crawling out of China and the Soviet Union, stirring up trouble all through the world, and especially in Southeast Asia. They had infected the ideology of a liberation movement in a little country called Vietnam. And by God, we were going to draw a line there, because if we didn't there, the dominoes would fall and all of Southeast Asia, from Vietnam to Laos to Cambodia, they would all fall to the Reds. And so he was going to stop that. He started sending advisors into Vietnam. This all cost money. And it also cost the country Eisenhower's warning. Kennedy was not afraid of getting the government married to large industrial corporations and to military war machine companies. We would get all of us together at our greatest, and then we would have the unions as the countervailing force, and we would rise as a nation and face down the Reds in Russia and the Reds in China. This was going to cost freaking vast sums of money. Now understand that back then, the tax rate, the top marginal tax rate, had been 90%. It had gone down to 70%. But we were taxing the hell out of the rich. Now they cry crocodile tears if they have to pay a couple of pennies after they've gone through all their tax loopholes. But we had money. We did. To be able to pay for this. And we could also rely on the Fed to do a little bit of juice on the money supply just to keep interest rates low so that we could do this multi-pronged attack on the problems of the modern world. And we were going at it. We fired off the Mercury series. There were three series to get to the moon. One manned capsules to see if we could make it live in space and be there. That was Mercury. Then there was Gemini, two people at a time, and we would have them do walks outside of the space station to see how that worked, what the dynamics were and all that. Then the third stage would be the Apollos, three with a lander, and that would pop us to the moon and bring our guys back alive. Okay, we were getting that done. News was showing these amazing things. Humans in space, zero gravity. War on poverty. We were beginning to address the poor in the country. We were talking about things like a food stamp program. Things that, a kind of medical insurance if you couldn't afford to get health care, Medicaid. Those kinds of things. We were talking about maybe building giant skyscrapers or large buildings so poor people could live in a better place and have subsidized rent. And then we were sending these advisors to that ungodly hole in the wall of Southeast Asia called Vietnam, which was more likely called Nam at the time. Okay, great. And also, he was out there in the limelight. So was Jackie. So the Camelot was alive. And people really did respond to it. And then there was a motorcade. He was in Dallas in an open motorcade in November of 1963. And some gunman ended Camelot. with Jack's brains lying in his wife's lap as they as she screamed and the motorcade took off down the road. Jack Kennedy's vice president was Lyndon Baines Johnson. Now, Johnson was no Kennedy. He was an old Southern conservative blue dog, as we call him, Democrat. A man who I would not be surprised had a Ku Klux Klan robe and hood in his closet. Hardcore. You see, Kennedy wasn't stupid. He had brought Johnson onto the ticket so that he could get his people on the East Coast and he could also attract the Bible Belt people and the conservative blue dogs of the South with his running mate, Johnson. So they made a good team. But now, they're on that Air Force One that night. And the story goes that Johnson was just mortified that he was going to be the president. He was hiding in a bathroom on Air Force One, sobbing. And they had to actually drag him out. And they cleaned him up, got his face looking good, and they got him in front of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who swore him in there on the plane. Famous photograph. He's standing there. Even in that photograph, you could tell that he was not comfortable with what had just happened. But you should have heard how happy the anti-Kennedy people were. They celebrated. Thank God we've got Johnson now instead of that liberal. I can tell you I was there in a church that Sunday after Kennedy was killed. The pastor was celebrating the death of the Antichrist. Finally, we will get God back into our country again. Just praying praises that the man was shot to death. I remember it quite distinctly because my mother, when she left the church in an angry storm, turned back and said a really bad word right to the pastor during his rant. That church was not holy that day after my mom was finished. Guarantee you. But, okay. Well, everyone assumed, well, Johnson, thank God, he's going to get some of this stuff aligned right. We won't have to worry about that civil rights stuff. Well, they were wrong. Lyndon Johnson, he had been a senator, and he had been the old-time, mean-as-dirt type. When the Senate was going to suspend debate on the civil rights nonsense, and Johnson started calling his old blue dog Southern Democrat friends from his Senate days into the White House, closed the door, and then he ripped them up and down. You will do this. You will vote for this Civil Rights Act. And if you don't, I know enough dirt on you that I will use it if you don't. They did, because Senator Lyndon Johnson, he was legendary. One of the famous stories about him was when he was running for the Senate in Texas, he was running against someone he knew, kind of a friend of his, and he told his assistant, I want you to get the rumor out that Ned is a pig. And his assistant, oh, Lyndon, Ned ain't no pig. Wife's kind of chunky, but shut up. I know he ain't no pig. But I want everyone to know that he had to deny it. That was how tough he was. And that's why those old blue dog Democrats, they walked out of there and they voted for it. And so the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, forbidding discrimination on the basis of race, color, creed, national origin. You do it, you go to prison. You lose your government funding. You lose everything if you do this, if you discriminate. The most powerful piece of there had been civil rights acts, don't get me wrong. There was even one in the 1860s, but this was something very different. It has shaped our world ever since. Even your lives are a lot improved, many of you, whatever color you are, religion. Okay, so he got that done. War on poverty, we're going to prosecute that war like hell. We're going to build those towers in Chicago, in L.A., in New York City. We're going to get the poor some money, some food stamps, all that. We are going to wage a war on poverty. And oh, by the way, never mind the advisors in Vietnam, send in troops and load that country down with bombs from the air. By the end, we lost 40,000 boys, and we laid onto that country several million tons of iron. Because, you know why? Johnson even said it. Why are we doing all these things? That's what Jack wanted. Jack wanted it, and so it's going to get done. That's the loyalty of a real friend. So we went to the mats. We were spending money hand over fist. And honestly, the economy could absorb. I mean, we had so much latency of production after World War II that in a lot of ways, this was what was needed, because it was like a reuptake of all that production we had to do to fight through a war on two massively separated theaters. And we did it. And so this production capacity was there. The economy could absorb. We could start to hire more people, not just the boys who come back from World War II. We could hire new kinds of people. We could force employers, at least to some extent. Even back then, we could bring women into the workforce because we needed everyone on board. We could make things happen. But we did do that at the expense of what Dwight Eisenhower warned us not to do. And of course, the Fed was doing its part. It wasn't horrendous, but the Fed would definitely be standing ready to bring the money supply up a little bit, print money to fund these operations, and keep this economy rolling forward. It was, the term at the time was, it was guns and butter. We'll do them both, and we'll do them right, and we'll put enough money in that we can get it done. We're not going to go cheap on this. We're going to go full on. War on poverty, war on communism, and we are going to make it to the moon by the end of the 1960s. Well, by God, we got to the moon on July the 20th of 1969. None of these fancy computers and all of this techie stuff. It was just pipes with water and pneumatics and all of that stuff and radios that you dialed. We did it. And we were laying waste to Vietnam, too. Unfortunately, we were drafting people. And the complaints, the protests began to get really serious. By the time of the election of 1968, Johnson just stepped away. He said, I'm not running for president again. I've had enough. There's not an appreciation of what we're doing. The kids hate me. No, my blue dog Southern Democrats, they hate me for what I did that they didn't like. He just walked away. And so in the 1968 election, of all people, Richard Nixon won the election. Now, you've probably been given a completely negative view of Nixon. Yeah, he's the guy who resigned from the White House. He was impeached. That's all true. But there was another side to it, too, that I have to bring up here. It's necessary to, you can't lie and know economics and finance. You can't look at only one side. You have to take the whole thing into account. Nixon was an asshole. His strategy for winning 1968 was called the Southern Strategy. He was going to win every vote of every white senator, every white citizen of the South by going full on sounding like a racist. And it worked. And then he tried to look a little more moderate to the people up north. But his southern strategy worked, and it was dirty. It was nasty. But it worked. He was also, of course, the one who was had to resign because of the Watergate scandal. A third-rate burglary he found out about after the fact, but then he tried to cover it up. And so he resigned. So, yeah, there's that bad side of it. But there was also the other side. Richard Nixon, actually, the Supreme Court justices he appointed came to become the most liberal Supreme Court the country had ever seen before and has ever seen since. Most of the constitutional law that was drawn favoring the rights of people, discriminated against, treated badly, that came from the Supreme Court justices he appointed. He also was a president who signed the legislation creating the Environmental Protection Act, which was the rock of legislation that brought us our first actual action against the pollution of America. He did that, too. So there is not a, well, all bad or all good. Very complex figure there. So, Nixon came to office. Well, he wasn't going to say no. We were on the verge of landing on the moon, for God's sake. So that kept going. And war on poverty? Well, I guess. It was kind of like, well, yeah, I suppose that's a good idea. And then at Vietnam, Johnson was prosecuting that war viciously. Nixon, being a Republican conservative, he sure wasn't going to say, let's leave Vietnam. I mean, that would have made him look like he's soft on communism. He wasn't going to do that. Just pour more troops in. Lay more napalm. Lay more iron. Do the whole thing. So everything just kept going. And the problem was that that was going to become very expensive. More money. But the thing was that expected inflation hadn't really caught up yet. The markets just, it had been so long. It was really the last real serious inflation was right after World War II, when the government printed a bunch of money to pay off its war bonds. But since then, the markets and workers and businesses weren't used to inflation. So there was not really an embedded expectation of it yet. So we could bring down the risk-free rate because we were bringing down the real rate and the expected inflation premium wasn't reacting upward. Well, he was reelected in 1972. Kind of the logic of it was his opponent was weak, but there was also the sense that by the 72, Nixon was, his people were in process of negotiating a peace agreement with the Vietnamese, the communists in Vietnam. We'd leave, you'd get it, but you would do this, this, and this so that you didn't hurt people and all, you know. And so there was almost a sense, well, we're going to vote for him. He's not the greatest guy in the world, but we're going to vote for him because see if he can get this war over with and bring the boys home. Then something bad happened. Wasn't our doing directly. You see, there was this little tiny country that we really supported, poured money into, poured all kinds of things into. And then there were all these big countries all around it that hated this little country. I mean, really hated it. What I'm talking about is Israel versus the Arab republics. And they'd had a couple of wars, you know, and Israel had always come out on top. And then the Arab countries got together, and in a blitz, they laid an attack down on Israel. And Israel took no fewer than 7 days to destroy the Arab nations' armies, wipe them out. Literally tens of thousands of Arab troops killed, tanks, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Arab nations' tanks and artillery pieces left to burn in the deserts. It was a rout again. And this time the Arab nations asked a question. How is it that a little tiny country like that can kick our collective ass? Oh, it's because they get all of that money, all of those jets, all of those sophisticated missiles and bombs and intelligence services from the United States. So the Arab nations got together, and under the banner of the oil-producing and exporting countries, OPEC, they turned the oil spigots off to the United States. You want our oil, but you coddle our enemy? Really? Well, try to have your cars go without our dirty or Arab oil. It was hardcore realpolitik. And so the OPEC oil embargo happened. Supply of oil, therefore gasoline, distillates like diesel, kerosene, jet fuel, the supplies just went through the floor. Prices skyrocketed. And of course, Nixon placed wage and price controls. Just stop right there for God's sake. Prices cannot go above this. Well, of course, that's not going, all that did was create shortages. And I remember them vividly looking out from my window down toward the interstate way off in the distance. Lines out miles onto the interstate to a gas station waiting for 1 or 2 gallons of gas at ridiculous prices for that time. I mean, there were fights, shootings. It was awful. And, of course, my family, we would, late at night, my brother would take me to this gas station where we'd buy black market gasoline at 5 to 10 times the price that was at the pump, the controlled price. You could get it. It was just black market. And I thought that was really cool. But anyway, okay. The economy rapidly was tailing toward a recession. So what does the Fed do? We will write this down. Monetize the price shock. We will monetize the price shock. You understand that when one price goes up, that's not inflation. Because that just means that if people spend the money on that, they have less to spend on other things, and those prices will go down. But when the Fed prints money to monetize a price shock, that spreads the explosion across all prices. That's what caused the inflation to begin in earnest. Adding liquidity all those years was like putting the fuel on a fire. And then when the monetization of the price shock of the OPEC oil embargo hit, it was like throwing the match on. Woof! The inflations began. Even with the wage and price controls, it was seeping out around the edges, prices going up everywhere. And the expected inflation premium began to rise. So as the Fed was trying to push down interest rates, expected inflation was going up. So the risk-free rate was beginning to no longer drop. In fact, it was beginning to drift upward. Well, as the economy got sicker, the Fed printed more money, which brought down the real rate again. But now, expected inflation was getting embedded in the markets. And it was forward inflation. It was 4% this year. Knowing what the Fed's doing, it'll be 6% next year. So they were running, the expected inflation rate was actually beginning to run ahead upward of the real rate of return, which was trying to just stay kind of like down. Nixon resigned in 74, and in 19, and he appointed Gerald R. Ford became the president, his vice president. Now, Ford was a moderate, he was a nice guy. He was a moderate Republican, kind of goofy. He did things like he'd keep bumping his head on. He was a tall guy. He'd keep cracking his head so he'd be show up in pictures. The president's got a bandage across his forehead. He was a nice guy. It's hard to say anything bad about him. He was a cool guy. But the thing was that he didn't understand what was happening. And part of it was he did not have any political capital whatsoever. No one would have listened to him anyway. So his way of dealing with this inflation that was beginning to spiral upward, he had hundreds of thousands of lapel buttons printed, and they had on them WIN, W-I-N, whip inflation now. Yeah, that's how we're going to stop inflation. We're going to wear buttons that say whip inflation now. Of course, that's not going to work. You know, it's like saying stop global warming now. We'll all wear a button and it'll stop. Oh yeah, there we go. Stop that asteroid now. Anyway. Well, he lost the 1976 election. He was wearing the... Mostly, it wasn't the inflation problem, which was getting pretty serious. It was more that he represented the legacy of Richard Nixon. And at that time, Nixon was considered, you know, the Antichrist and all that. So he lost to a man from Georgia who was a peanut farmer, but he was also a nuclear physicist, Jimmy Carter. Now, Jimmy Carter was a Democrat, but he was also very conservative in many ways, evangelical to some extent, very religious man, very moral man. And he went on TV for these fireside chats, telling everyone, we need to turn down the heat in our houses. We need to drive less, walk more. We need to do this, this, and this. We need to put solar panels on our homes. And he'd sit there at these fireside chats wearing these massive sweaters. He looked like he was shivering in the White House because they had the temperature so low, to serve as an example to everyone. We can do this. We can get through this difficult period, low oil supplies, prices going up. In fact, he did Gerald Ford one better than the WIN buttons. He had a bunch of buttons printed, and he got on TV and he said, we have to consider that inflation is the moral equivalent of war. Meow. Oh, he was just eaten alive by the wags in the cartoons, political cartoons. Meow. Well, the thing was, though, that he was actually a highly educated man. He knew damn well what really was going on. And he also knew what it was going to take to stop it. You see, promises were no longer going to work. The Fed had been saying, we'll cut the money supply, don't worry. And then they lied. They just kept doing it. And so there was a lack of any credibility in the financial markets at that time. We were already beginning to get some pretty bad interest rates because the expected inflation premium was so high, and it kept increasing because of increasing cynicism that the government could ever stop the problem. Well, Carter did what had to be done. He appointed in 1979, I believe it was, he appointed as the chairman of the Federal Reserve this big, cigar-smoking, foul-mouthed, hateful sociopath. He was a great guy. His name was Paul Volcker. Now, Volcker is still alive. Paul Volcker said, we're going to cut the money supply. And of course, the market said, yeah, whatever. Jack up, here he comes. He's going to do more of the same. Jack up the expected inflation rate. Here comes a new lie. Well, Volcker wasn't lying. He crushed the money supply. In literally a matter of days, he brought it down like this. Just draining liquidity, burning money, whatever was necessary. He crushed the money supply. The real rate of return skyrocketed. There was the expected inflation premium through the roof, and suddenly the real rate of return goes through the roof. Well, there were interest rates in the economy, 25% mortgage rates, 30% bond coupon rates. We went spiraling down. And of course, it would take literally several years before the financial markets would know that the man was not kidding. In the meantime, came the 1980 election. We were suffering from a stagnating economy and inflation, the combination of which is stagflation. And of course, Carter went up against a former actor who had become the governor of California. As an actor, he'd been in Western movies and done cigarette commercials. His name was Ronald Reagan. And he kicked Carter's ass in the 1980 election because everyone blamed Jimmy Carter for the stagflation. Look at that stupid son of a bitch. He was peanut farmer. No, I mean, you can't explain to stupid people that this was what had to be done. Anyway, Reagan came into office, and he was very conservative, but he was a good man in a lot of ways. The first thing he did was he instituted a big tax cut just to juice the economy that way. He left Volcker alone. He knew, and his advisors, that this was what had to be done. And we were just going to have to crawl out of it. The tax cut helped. It made people have a little more money. It juiced the economy a little bit. And little by little, as the financial markets began to realize Volcker was dead serious, the expected inflation premium began to drain out of the markets in 81, 82, really 82. So Volcker still held the money supply tight. So the real rate, he didn't let down for another maybe 9 months to a year. But eventually, he then let the money supply start going back so that it was growing at the rate it should. It would grow at the growth rate of the real economy. And so we came into a period of pretty strong stability in the, and again, this goes to that thing. Markets don't like excitement. We want stability. We will not believe that you're going to bring that to us right away. We, in the financial markets, we can't rely on promises. So if we think that there's going to be 12% inflation next year, we're going to put a 12% inflation premium into your mortgage loan. That's just how it is. So you have to create, once you have damaged your credibility, it takes a long time to rebuild it. And so in the 1980s, through the policies, especially in Reagan's second term in office, his policies were stable. He did some stupid things in his first term, trusting people he shouldn't have. But in the second term, we had stability. And we also had the Federal Reserve being shepherded by a man who didn't lie. Interestingly enough, by the time we get to the later 1980s, Ronald Reagan himself had gone into dementia. Almost no one knew about it. But there was a group of Republicans around him and some Democrats, including his wife Nancy Reagan, who actually sort of put a wall around him and the next president, George H.W. Bush, his vice president, and Howard Baker and a few others. They essentially created this wall around him so that the financial markets and the country in general would see that there was still this man, Ronald Reagan, there, and so we could still have stability. We didn't need to panic. We didn't need to do things to the money supply. We didn't need to do things to interest rates. We didn't need to have a whole new political regime. And it worked. We stayed in that zone. The same thing happened maybe 8 years later and into the 1990s with the administration of a Democrat, Bill Clinton. It's not who you are as far as politics go. It's how you conduct yourself in the governance of an economy. You don't do stupid things. Eisenhower knew that. Carter knew it, but he had no choice. Nixon understood it. Reagan understood it. Clinton understood it. This is how you create a strong economy. And it all has to do with that stupid equation that I wrote right there on the board. This is what we mean when we talk about volatility. It's not what we really like in finance. Who knows? Maybe sometime in your lifetimes, we'll see the return of Camelot. That's all I have for you.